The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
Hello there, welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, broadcaster Sinead Ní Ollachán told me about the new T.G. Cahir documentary, which is hoping to change how we think about Peg Sayers by showing that there's more to her legacy than leaving Sir Dredd. Stephen Murphy is assistant professor in marketing in Trinity College Dublin, and he talked to me about how conspiracy theories can flourish online and why people believe, spread and act upon fake news. Dublin writer Roisin Kybert spoke to me about the dystopian aspects of life with technology, which can be as unsettling and disturbing as they are enlightening. And presenter, singer and mum Stacey Solomon told me about her new book, Tap to Tidy. It's a guide to organising, crafting and creating happiness in a messy world. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. Let me say good morning to our friend and colleague, Sinead Ní Ollachán. Good morning, Sinead.
Oh, hello, Ryan. How are you?
Did I make it bags of that, or are we okay?
Not at all. We are Giad Fon Giad, 100%.
Gahanawa Fod. Anyway, Foilchit could be on programme on Clara on Shaw in you.
Gramila Mahaga.
And
nice to be speaking to you.
It was very good to be speaking to you because you are doing something that I think was required some time ago, which is you are rehabilitating, you are reevaluating, you are spreading some light and joy about the world of Peg Sayers. Now, the big question is quite straightforward, one word, three letters. Why?
Why? I suppose I'm spreading light and joy and love maybe as well, because I'm trying in this new documentary that will air soon on T.G. Cahir to look at Peg in a positive light.
Okay.
To, I suppose, reevaluate who Peg Sayers was. We've heard a lot about her, and when we hear people speak about Peg Sayers, mostly it's about the Leaving Cert. Mostly it's about that little pink book that so many people study.
You just triggered.
And you see
just triggered.
Can you imagine it?
Just be triggered by you, Sinead. I can see it now. Go on, keep going.
I actually have a copy right in front of me.
I'll leave it there.
And I suppose many people studied Peg. It was on the curriculum, I think, from like 1962 to 1999.
So
that's
really?
A long
Did it last that far?
Time. Yeah, yeah. And now I didn't have to study Peg. So I decided for this particular program that I would take a personal journey, take a trip down memory lane. I'm from West Kerry. I'm from a place called Balneonic, which isn't far at all from Dunqueen, where Peg grew up. It's not far at all from the Blasket Islands. And when I was young, during the summers, I worked in Unad an Bhlaskaid Mhuir, the heritage centre.
Oh, beautiful.
Dunqueen.
Oh, I've never been.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous. I would recommend to go. But I worked in the restaurant there for years.
Oh.
I spent my summers there. That was my summer job, working with Christy and Dave and Sharon and Mary and all the rest down there.
Gorgeous.
Wonderful time.
So, go ahead.
I was just a little bit, I suppose, embarrassed because I always heard about Peg Sayers and I knew about Peg Sayers, but I didn't really know that much about her at
yes.
the same time. I had never read the book. I knew that she was a storyteller. I knew that she had a hard life. I knew that she got a lot of, I suppose, stick from people who had read the book and who had studied the book. But I wanted to take, I suppose, a personal journey and to understand who Peg was. And that's hopefully what I've done with this programme.
It's a good start to our chat because for those who haven't a clue what we're talking about, that is to say people under 35 or thereabouts, and for people who just didn't study Irish or who are new to the country, whatever it might be, well, I would have studied Peg as a pass Irish student, and when I say pass, they just didn't have another level for me to go down. But the point I'm making is I'll try and remember what I remember about Peg. She stole an apple pie under her armpit. She ended up being kind of slightly annoyed about Coach Jim, who skedaddled to America and didn't send the money back. Somebody fell out of a coffin.
Yeah.
And they're the three. That's all I can remember about Peg after 2.5 years of studying.
Yeah, but remember, what's in the book, Peg, is a certain period of her life, but there's so much more to her as well, and she collected so many more stories that aren't even registered in this book. So I suppose, to give people a background, Peg Sayers, born in 1873 in Dunquin, married into the island, the Great Blasted Island, and spent her life there. And I suppose many people came to the island to collect stories from her, lots of storytellers, people from Cnosach Vale Idis Éireann, the Folklore Commission of Ireland. And it came to pass that she told her life story to her son, Mike Fille. He wrote it down. It was then edited by Maureen Eakin-Ada, and it became the book that so many people studied for the Leaving Cert. So it's kind of a little bit like Chinese Whispers, I think. You know, she told her story to her son. They say her son was quite religious as well. So I wonder, did Mike Fille take note of everything? I mean, and there's supposed a certain editorial there as well. And then it was passed on to Maureen Eakin-Ada, and then it was published, and it became the book that was on the Leaving Cert for such a long period of time, 62 to 99. And I suppose during that period of time, it became the stuff of nightmares for many people, because Peg had a hard life. It was hard on the island. She lost, I think she had 11 children and six of them survived. She had a tough life, as many people did at the time. So I suppose people remember that element or that part of her life. And think about it. You're a 17, 18-year-old Leaving Cert student.
Grumpy.
I'm sure you don't want to be reading about something that is so hard, and the hardship and all that she suffered and endured. But that was her life, and that was her story. And all she did was tell it to her son, as was required of her. So I think Peg gets a lot of stick that she doesn't deserve.
I agree with you. I think because I'm older now, I realise that this book is an important part of social oral history and storytelling, and what we do so well in the country.
Yeah.
Now, that's one. But I will say, and you correctly say, Sinead, imagine being 16, 17, 18 and being faced with this story. I found it wasn't the grimness of her life. I didn't mind that at all. To me, it was, I'll use the word again, a trigger. It just, it was like what the Glenroe Sig tune did to me on a Sunday night at 8:30. Peg would have been a visual and Gaeilge representation of that too. It just reminded me of, you know, working for the Leaving Cert and at a subject I wasn't very good at. And therefore, through no fault of her own necessarily, Peg became a sort of totem for things that instilled fear in me.
Yeah, and I can completely understand why. And I suppose this programme that we worked on, we tried to look at Peg in a positive light, because there are so many people who didn't study Peg, who don't have those withdrawal symptoms or PTSD when they hear her name or see that pink book. And for those people, they're reimagining Peg. They're coming up with creative ways to celebrate her. And that's what we've looked at in this programme. There are people who are composing pieces of music based on some of Peg's stories. And you'll see that, no spoiler alert. There's also a young woman from County Mayo, no connection to County Kerry, who has decided to get a tattoo of Peg.
Yes.
Now,
how old is she?
She is in her early 20s.
And is she a hipster?
She looked pretty hip when I met her.
Yeah, you too. That's quite a hipstery thing to do, I think. And kind of impressed. Your programme, it's a documentary?
Documentary, yes.
I think it's, I cannot wait to see it, because I think,
cool.
first of all, TG Carr is just, I think, arguably the best channel on TV at the moment. Secondly, and that includes all the digitals and everything else. And secondly, I think this would be a very nice reintroduction to Peg for people like me who are scarred, who might then reevaluate it by watching your programme and kind of just having a more mature adult relationship with this historical figure.
Absolutely. And have you read the book, Ryan?
Well, I mean, I read the bits of it in Bad Irish, you know, when I was in school. I mean, it was part of my curriculum, but I was appalling.
And would you consider reading it again, even a translation of it? No.
No. I jest when I say that really quickly. I'm being glib. What I'd love to do is this. One, I'm going to look at your programme. Two, I would love to go to the Blasket, to the Interpretive Centre, and, you know, as part of our next Wide Atlantic Way, I would definitely take the Peg story in. Do you know what I mean? And then take it from there. But I see at the centre, Maureen Nidolig.
Yes.
I said something very interesting. She said Peg was the Netflix of her time.
She was, because lots of people gathered in Peg's house to hear her tell stories. You can imagine back in the day, there was no television, there was no radio or whatever. So I suppose the entertainment that they had was the stories that they had collected. So Peg would often have people gathered in her home, young people as well, as Maura Niholic told me, and Dáithí de Múra as well, telling stories. And that was the entertainment of the time. And she was a wonderful storyteller. I had the opportunity to go up to UCD to Knúsach Béal Idas Éireann and to actually listen to some of the tapes of her reciting. And she understood her brief. Yeah. She told the story. There was a rhythm to it. There was not an nor an am. It was like a performance.
Right.
And that's what I think of when I think of Peg. I think of a performer. Also, I think of Beyonce. You only have to say Beyonce and you know who someone's talking about. Somebody else mentioned this in the story, in the program as well. They said, all you have to say is Bono. All you have to say is Peg, and people know who you're talking about.
It's,
you know, she's
very
sure.
Fair point. She's the share of the baskets. Loved Peg's house as a text, and I read it every so often. That's from Martina in Sligo. Another says, the very mention of Peg caused an involuntary scream as I made my morning coffee, says Derek.
Has to watch the show.
There's no doubt about it. Very excited about Peg, says another. I had, and Cliona says, I had and have very bad Irish, but I adored doing Peg in school, and I look forward to seeing this documentary. Another says, oh no, Peg, she made me cry the whole 2 years of Leaving Cert, hence the burning of the book after the 1990 exams. The only time in my life I passed Irish in an exam was for the Leaving Cert. However, I have learned to take... to have a love of the great Blasket Island where she lived, thanks to the great work of Billy and Alice, who have brought the folklore of it back to me. So the older creatures like myself are kind of having a nostalgic look at this, which I think will make people watch your documentary on the 10th of March at 9:30 on TG Cahir and on The Player. It's a great idea, Sinead, no better woman for it, so I'm really looking forward to seeing it. Thank you.
Ryan. Thanks so much. Road.
Okay, see you soon. Thanks for that, Sinead.
Bye-bye.
Sinead Olacon joining us to talk about Peg, her documentary on the 10th of March, 9:30, on TG Cahir. That is something I look forward to immensely. It's 21 minutes to 10. Now, yesterday we were talking about the protests in Dublin on Saturday, and everyone I met in the last 48 hours is talking about it all the time. Fascinated. A lot of people felt frustrated by what they saw and how it made you feel about the people in your community, the people who actually showed up at the thing. And you wanted to know what brought them there. And the truth is, people went for lots of different reasons. Some of the reasons are out there. Some of the reasons are completely understandable as it happens. So it takes, all sorts of people to do all sorts of things, obviously. So why do people sometimes, and some of these people did, simply park their credulity at the door when they, log on and head down rabbit holes? I think a lot of people listening know somebody and have lost somebody to the rabbit hole of the internet. Somebody that they love, still do. Somebody that they trust, bit shaky ground nowadays. And somebody they might be worried about. And the person who's gone down the rabbit hole oftentimes will say, you're the problem, not me. So what's happening here? It's an intriguing conundrum. Stephen Murphy has been looking at the spread of conspiracy theories about the place, and he joins us now. Good morning, Stephen. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning, Ryan. Lovely to be on. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for being here. You're a marketing professor, originally from Waterford, I believe.
That's right. Yeah.
And you're an assistant professor of marketing in Trinity. So what I want to do is, that just puts the credentials on the table, if you like. Why are we losing a lot of people to the rabbit hole of online conspiracy theories? What's happening? Is there a broad answer to this?
I think there's probably lots of different answers to it, and
sure.
we probably have to tune in to the time and the place, and recognize the factors that are making it making people turn to conspiracies more and more. I think the pandemic has obviously created a kind of fertile ground, I suppose, for the spread of conspiracy theories.
Mm.
People have found themselves in situations that are hard to believe. If you think about the economy basically shutting down, unemployment rates, I suppose, are obviously soaring. And also, we're not able to leave our home. At least we're not supposed to go more than 5K outside of our home. So we've lost a lot of the kind of personal freedoms that we took for granted, I think. And, you know, if you would have said maybe a year and a half ago that this would be the situation we'd find ourselves in, you would have probably said, that sounds like a conspiracy theory. So I think this has kind of created a perfect storm, really. And what we see is that people are kind of feeling financial pressure, they're feeling really isolated, they're cut off from people. And during this time then, they're turning more and more to social media, you know, so we're filling the time really on social media. Mm. And that is created a perfect condition really for the spread of conspiracy theories.
They go to the social media, and what do they find there? What is the attraction to get them away from the darkness that is the reality, economic, mental health, emotional, what have you?
Yeah, so I think what we've seen in our research is that a lot of people are going to social media trying to find answers to explain the situations that they find themselves
okay.
in. You know, so whether you've lost a job or, you know, you're under pressure for keeping up with your mortgage or whatever
yeah.
those kind of real life pressures are, well, people find themselves with more time. They go onto social media and they go looking for answers. And these kind of conspiracy explanations are only a click away, really. You know, when you join particular groups and, you know, as you said earlier, going down the rabbit hole. So it really gives people access to a whole kind of range of information that wasn't accessible, I think, probably before social media.
But the difficulty is that you've got good people finding insane non-formation, let's call it that, where they're saying, all right, so you know, and I mentioned the most stupid thing of them all, which is that, you know, they're injecting baby blood into RTE presenters to make them look younger. I mean, I was laughing over the weekend about that, saying, oh, yeah, I remember talking to Eamon Devlair about this when I was a kid in school. And then I stopped being, you know, facetious about it and went, but people actually kind of believe that the government is a bunch of paedophiles. Yeah. This is, it goes from comical to sinister to, it's fine if it's 1% of crazy horses, but when that becomes a bigger percentage of good people turning peculiar, now we've got to kind of notice. And then you don't want to notice too much because then you're feeding the beast. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, I think it is a really tricky one. I think, you know, those types of, like the ones you mentioned, I heard about the RTE presenters being injected and all of that. And I think they are very much at the extreme end of conspiracy
yeah.
theories. But I think what we've got to try to resist doing is to kind of take, you know, quotes around those kind of things and let them represent the whole phenomenon and what's happening. Because you'll find, I think, across the spectrum, there's much more reasonable explanations to what's going on than those kind of ones, you know, but still within the kind of conspiratorial
okay,
space,
so
if you like.
In other words, that if you look at the protests in Dublin on Saturday, and there's loads more planned, I have no doubt that there were a bunch of people at that protest who are fed up, who think that this thing has gone on too long and their business is screwed and they're really upset and they don't believe that there's a basement in a pizzeria, you know, filled with Hillary Clinton and other paedophiles. They actually are just angry. But do they get mixed up then with the crazier element who are saying about the injections and about the government and so on? Is that what's happening? Is this a kind of a weird, heady mix of righteously angry people and just other people who are just believing complete balderdash?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably a good way of thinking about it. Like, to explain the events that happened at the weekend just in terms of the kind of the more extreme stuff, I think would be to overlook the situation that
yeah.
maybe a lot of people who turned up at that protest are actually experiencing.
Yeah, good people who are just angry.
Yeah, and my research has been in the UK, so, you know, I can't stretch too much into the...
Yeah, well, give us a sense of what you've learned. Yeah, please.
Yeah, but, you know, from speaking to people who've kind of fallen into conspiracies, you can certainly see that there's always a sense of kind of disenfranchisement, or they feel excluded, or they feel not heard, or they've lost trust in the kind of, in the system or in authority, and maybe even sometimes in kind of experts in general. So I think all of those things kind of come together, and that's what motivates people to start looking for alternative explanations. And I would, I would think that if you spoke to people who were at that march on Saturday, that you would hear a lot of those same kind of things about not feeling heard and feeling overlooked by society. And basically, they want a platform. They want to be heard.
Is for some of them, and for some of the people who get involved in the crazy kind of QAnon side of MAD. Is there a sense of finding a tribe, to use that oft-used expression, that they have found a home, or at least a status?
Definitely. You know, if you think about maybe conspiratorial beliefs, you know, if you were to try to maybe, you know, share those when you're down in the pub with friends, or you know, with family at the dinner table.
Yeah, I'd be disowned.
Yeah, exactly. You're likely to experience some kind of pushback. You know, people will put you back in your place.
Push off the cliff. Go on.
Yeah, exactly. But on social media, when you join these groups, you know, you're meeting with like-minded people.
Yes.
And so there's a sense of status to be gained by sharing conspiratorial beliefs, and also the ones then who kind of, I guess, develop a reputation and a sense of status within the community are the ones who go further down the rabbit hole.
And then you become the shaman in Capitol Hill.
Exactly. Okay. You know, you're the one who can deal with the information that's kind of too hot for other people to handle.
Wow.
There's a sense of status there, yeah.
Yeah. Stephen, I we'll talk again, because this conspiracy theory thing is, I mean, I thought it was just in America, in my ignorance. I thought, that look at them. And now I'm looking at my news at 6 o'clock on a Saturday night going, oh, it's landed. So it's intriguing. Thank you for your time, Stephen. Very nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Likewise, Stephen Murphy joining us on the phone there to talk about that. And as somebody says, please do more about this topic. It started before the pandemic. It's really serious, and I've lost a friend to this. That's what I was saying at the very beginning of that chat. I think everyone, well, not everyone, a lot of people listening will have lost somebody. Not just, by the way, to crazy conspiracy, crazy stuff, but to Twitter and to too much time online. And it's not about, and when I say that, I'm not trying to say, look at them. I'm saying we need to fix it. It's not, I'm not trying to say that they're all bad. They're not. It's far from it. Just it needs to be looked at and dealt with. And that's why we did that today. At 9:27 thereabouts this Wednesday morning, very good to have you with us. Roisin Kybert is a Dublin writer. She's focusing on technology and culture and the intersection between the two, because we are just obsessed with technology these days. Roisin, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
Not at all. Congratulations on your, well, it's a collection of essays. That really, what I'm so happy about talking to you this morning is largely because of the year you were born.
1989.
Precisely, which makes you, does it make that make you a digital native or not? Am I right in saying that?
Oh,
or?
Very much so. Yeah. I start my book, it's called The Disconnect,
yeah.
And it's out in a few days. But I started with a history of the world since 1989, beginning with March 1989, when Tim Berners-Lee first filed the kind of, he first created the outline of the WWW layer of the internet. So we could say I'm exactly as old as the World Wide Web.
You are the World Wide Web.
I'm raised by the internet, as I say in the book.
Yeah, indeed, and raised by internet wolves in many respects, because it's one of those, there's a beauty and a menace to the internet, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. That sums it up so perfectly. And that's what I wanted to capture in The Disconnect, actually. It was that, you know, it's not purely a darkness, but there is a lot of darkness there. And I think it's something an entire generation can speak to, and everyone younger than me too, I would imagine.
You were 12. You got the Nokia 8210, and was that the right age to get the phone? I think that sounds about normal these days, isn't it?
Yeah, I could even imagine people getting them younger now, actually, and parents telling themselves that it's a necessity. And I wouldn't disagree with them. I think something that's interesting is I'm old enough to have caught the last of the benign internet. and young enough to probably have experienced it also at its worst.
Take us back, Roisin, to the benign internet times, because there's now people listening going, what is this Oz you speak of?
Yeah, I think one where it was more segmented according to interests. So it wasn't this big, endless scrolling timeline of just angry voices clashing with each other, you know?
Yeah.
It was people actually building their own websites, customizing them.
Yeah.
There was so much more creativity as well. I kind of have like a... almost like a moment of original sin for the internet being the invention of Facebook, because suddenly we had to use our real names and we had to make our entire personalities fit into this grid of just, you know, boring white and blue, and everything has to be very proper and bland. I have a chapter in The Disconnect called Bland God, Notes on Mark Zuckerberg. I really do see him as a merchant of blandness in the world.
What a great description of obviously an incredibly smart guy, but a poster boy for everything that is bland and vanilla and largely uninteresting. Yeah. Why is that? And how do we get sucked into such basic nonsense?
I'm really interested in this, actually. I think there's this idea that dates back to around the 90s of the personal brand. So the internet is going to, you know, they knew at that time, like, the internet is going to change work, it's going to change relationships, it's going to change everything about how we behave in everyday life.
Yes.
And you will only really be as good as your presence on the internet. So you have to market yourself like a brand.
So you're defined by your presence online.
Yeah. And I think that caught on originally with maybe first these kind of business ebook guys, and then later, you know, MySpace and these kind of mad creatives. But then the most normal version, or in the book I describe it as normcore, is Facebook, where it's that sort of one-size-fits-all, here's your page, and now talk to each other, but don't say anything too exciting, you know?
Because you'd be called out for being different.
Yeah, potentially. I think there is something very conformist about Facebook. But then, I mean, that's confounding, because now it's a home of conspiracies. I mean, I would blame a lot of QAnon and even what happened at the weekend in Ireland on Facebook, personally. I mean, they're facilitating conspiracy theories right now.
Indeed. In fact, a lot of the online big corporate head companies are doing a lot of facilitating and enabling and propagating, and while at the same time shrugging their shoulders like an emoji saying, what, us? We just give you the wall. I don't care. We're not responsible for the graffiti.
I think you've probably seen it over the years in that, like, a company like Facebook, the impact that it has had on media alone is beyond measure, and yet they refuse to, you know, take accountability for that. They say they're not a media company. But in so many ways they are. I mean, I kind of allude to it a little bit in the first chapter in the book, but I worked as a journalist for years, and I watched as so many places went bankrupt or else kind of went into chaos trying to adapt to the internet, trying to create content. It's always that word, content. And, you know, it was catering to what Facebook wanted from them, but ultimately Facebook doesn't care.
Because they want to what?
Well, for instance, I used to write a column for Motherboard, and at the beginning of The Disconnect, I'm still writing that column, and it's studying internet subcultures. But about a year or two later, a lot of journalists lost their jobs because Facebook told them video content is more important. And so they fired the journalists and they hired videographers. And then it turned out Facebook was lying about its metrics, and the videos weren't getting as much interaction as they said.
And that changes everything. You talk about, because you got into the technology game and you became a cheese for a while.
I did.
Roisin. Yes. It's not every day you're able to ask somebody about their life as a cheese, but maybe throw some light on that for us, please.
My year as a cheese, it was a formative experience. It's in the first chapter of The Disconnect. I kind of begin with myself working in London at an ad agency, where they were just beginning to get in on social media. And by the end of the year I spent there, they had moved a lot of people onto the social media team because it was obvious this is not something you can wait for, you know? Mm. But they assigned me this brand of cheddar cheese. So I spent my days talking mostly to teenage girls about cheddar cheese. And then at one point, Harry Styles said that it was his favourite food and that he missed it in an interview. He missed it in England. And so suddenly I had this influx of One Direction fans. And that became my sort of day-to-day life, just talking, trying to convince these girls to do, buy cheese. And they were trying to convince me to connect them to Harry Styles, even though I'm just a cheese. What can I do?
Yeah,
that was an odd job. But, yeah. I mean, that to me is, that epitomizes just the kind of mundane, surreal quality, you know, that the internet has. And I mean, that was a mission of mine with writing The Disconnect. It was, I want to point out the kind of everyday but utterly strange things that technology has done to everyday life.
Yeah, it's hard for you, I suspect, to write about it because I feel it's such an evolving story in the sense that we still don't know quite how controlled we are by this thing, the phone in the pocket, the internet, the service, the online companies I just mentioned. You know, it'll take probably another little while for us to realise that we walked eyes wide open into a cesspit. Too often, it's a cesspit. Anyway, let's talk about your the idea of you with the phone going home. And like so many people, without, this is what I'm talking about as well, not just the cesspit, because the internet has great things, et cetera, but you can go home with your phone and suddenly you're on 24-7. And you found that too. I mean, that's, it's kind of an insidious way of getting at you.
I think so. I think, you know, when the pandemic started, I kind of thought, oh no, I'm launching a book in lockdown. Mm. I think it's more relevant than ever, actually, because now that boundary between work and your private life and your personal, like your time, has completely collapsed. You know, I've been a freelancer for a long time, so I had to reckon with this before everyone else. But it's the first kind of three essays in the book are about this, about being always on, and about how the body is almost treated as a machine. And you see that in so many, in kind of so much of the rhetoric coming out of Silicon Valley, this obsession with productivity, with, you know, controlling, with optimizing the self. But for the average person, like for me, working, living in Dublin, writing about the internet, I kind of took that on way too much personally. And I have this chapter in the book called The Night Gym, and it's about my time going to a 24-hour super gym in the Docklands. I would spend, and you know, at the time, I think this is like a disconnect. I had just sunk so deep into really disordered thinking. I mean, I'm quite an obsessive person. I think writers tend to be that way.
Yes, you were doing that thing so many people are doing for some weird reason, listening to podcasts about serial killers.
Oh, very much so, yes. Walking through town at night, listening to podcasts about serial killers.
Perfect. Background ambience for your walk through the city centre.
Yes. But there's something so noirish about the Docklands anyway, and it was only later that I realised, like, I brought that essay out first in the Dublin Review, and I remember someone said that it reminded them of an Edward Hopper painting, but of tech Dublin.
Yes, yeah. That's our Silicon Docklands.
Yeah, and then that kind of extreme, you know, nature of just like, the internet never sleeps, so you shouldn't sleep either.
Yes.
It fascinates me. I see it mapping out into so many, like, you don't have to be a freelancer to be always on now. If you have a phone, you carry your work around with you, and young people especially, they don't know how to say no, because they're scared that they'll lose their jobs, or, you know, that they won't get work anymore, so they just do that. But then they become almost like automata, you know?
Yes, yeah. I think it'd be terrifying to be heading into the workplace for the first time now. And as you say at one point, if you're feeling isolated or lonely, you go on Twitter and get into a fight. Or if you're worried about the virus, you download the tracking app. You know, all the answers are to be found in technology, according to what we're being told, whereas actually a walk by the sea or look up at a tree and watch a bird making a nest actually could be much more rewarding.
Completely. I think technology offers itself as the cure for technology.
Okay, for sure. You had your own, I suppose, troubles in some ways with burnout and...
Yeah.
You just I think people get that burnout, and it's kind of hard to define because it's. I don't think there's necessarily a medical definition for it. But what happened in your case, Roshan?
Yeah, I begin the book with this. the disconnect is roughly like a kind of linear journey. It looks like a very winding journey, but for me it was a linear one. I started on a point of complete alienation and kind of paranoia. And really, ultimately, when I look back, it's the kind of state that the internet wants you to be in. Always connected, always,
yes.
You know, you're kind of brain chemicals flaring, ready to react, and ultimately very detached from the rest of humanity. So I was barely sleeping. I have like a history of eating disorders as well. And I kind of got in this idea that I had the perfect routine, which is so deceptive, that, you know, I was successful because I was working all the time and then running on a treadmill at 4 a.m, like in the Docklands at night. And ultimately, I just had a breakdown. I had a complete breakdown and I had to go into treatment. I got CBT after going on a waiting list for a long time and that helped a lot. But the other thing was a kind of self-knowledge, you know, with a lot of professional help too, but also just on my own. I think one thing I didn't have when I started the book, but that I have now at the end, is a kind of self-knowledge. When I'm scrolling, you know, the infinite scroll, it's never going to end. There will always be distraction there. But if it's hurting me, or if it's kind of uncomfortable, you know, it's like I'm just not actually any happier reading this, mainlining information, then I step away.
Exactly. And it's the self-discipline to know when to start. I see people, and, you know, they might be, not necessarily working, but around the place and scrolling, but they look dead behind the eyes. Like, what is it? Scrolling. Just head deep into the phone, just going, or like a hamster's wheel of death.
Yeah, you'll never run out of internet.
But what are you scrolling for? Like, what is the dopamine hit in that? It doesn't seem to, I never see them looking up for a moment going, I found it. I found what I was looking for. A meaningful message amongst all of this. The reeds of nothingness.
There's a lot of nothingness. I mean, it's something. I've read some really startling statistic, like the majority of the internet is spam. And I think then when we broaden the definition of spam to include just the kind of mundanities that we put up online every day, it's all spam almost. I mean, it was really important to me to capture this time of transition, you know, that this thing has crept into our lives and completely insinuated itself. And I'm not purely negative about this. There is a lot of, like, there's beauty. There's a kind of tragic beauty to some of the things that happen online. Like, I have an entire chapter in The Disconnect on vaporwave music, which is this weird, you know, kind of nostalgic, sad genre of music and art, produced mainly by millennials. And to me, it expresses perfectly the sort of loneliness and defeat, but also a sort of a beautiful sense of nostalgia and expert curation. People are so good at curating things now because they're on the internet. They're like swimming in information. And people are developing these weird new, you know, art forms there. So I did want to include the positives too.
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about the positives too, because it's too easy for curmudgeons like me on this subject to take over and to kind of point out to extenuate the negative. But you're right, and there are some beautiful things in it. But I loved your description of the internet as being something akin to the Garden of Eden, and then the original sin of Facebook arrived. And I don't want to be too harsh on Facebook. I find Facebook, particularly on I think they own Instagram, they're very good. If something awful happens on Instagram, they'll take it down very quickly. I noticed in my own, if somebody puts up a fake ID, so they'll take it down really quickly. So kudos to them. Twitter, on the other hand, desperate. Don't do it at all. You have to knock and knock and knock on the door and you mightn't even get an answer. So some are better than others, let's face it. But there are good things happening there. Tech says, I have a simple solution for all these tech companies. If you don't like their activities, which I despise, says this texter, simply stop using them. I don't use Google or Facebook. I refuse to check my phone for work purposes. We have the power. Just stop doing what these companies want you to do. And another from Stephen in Limerick says, I'm interested in your conversation about technology and the internet. I'm working currently on a dissertation about technology and teaching and learning in secondary schools. To a large degree, we are unquestioning about its use and how to use it and the real benefits of using it to help students to learn. We kind of drank the Kool-Aid, didn't we?
Yeah, this issue of there being an off button, I think that's really fascinating. Like, there's this infamous interview that one of the heads of Google gave a few years ago. It's the one that the line, I think it's Larry Page, it's the line, you know, we don't need you to tell us your information. We already know it. We can see where you are. We know basically what you're thinking. And he goes on to say later in that interview, but of course there is an off button. You can remember to press the off button, and it's almost smug when he says it. So I made a point in my book of not telling people, oh, delete your accounts. Because honestly, I don't believe that's an option for a lot of people. I know that sounds like a lazy excuse, but I noticed that the people who tend to advocate this are safely installed in careers where they didn't need social media to succeed initially.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's a total journalist's reply or a writer's reply, because obviously I have to use it more than most. And originally, the only people on Twitter were journalists. But I think it's kind of different for people below a certain generation. And I also would I would kind of argue that there is no off button, because surveillance capitalism, as it's called, it has really, like, it's in every aspect of our lives. I know a lot of, like, I live in Berlin most of the time now, which is this, you know, famously kind of a city of spies, and the legacy of the Stasi is there. And consequently, a lot of people hate tech. There are protests against Amazon. They ran Google out of Kreuzberg. But there and a lot of very data-conscious people who try to hide their information, and they might not even use credit cards. You know, everyone pays cash in Berlin. They still sometimes have to use these products. Like, and I think the most kind of telling detail is that I talk a lot in The Disconnect about patents filed by Facebook and various things that, like, we don't really see, but we have evidence of in the outside world that Facebook is doing behind the scenes. But, like, the shadow profile, the idea that you don't have to join Facebook for Facebook to know you exist and to create a profile based around your absence.
You're terrifying me now with this information. I thought you were a nice person, an intelligent person, and now you're just scaring me. So that's
it's a dark book.
I know it is. I know. No wonder you live in Berlin. You need a bohemian escape from reality to live there. I'd say it's a great old city.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's full of Irish people who can't afford to live in Dublin anymore. Could be because Google is raising the price of the city.
Maybe that's the whole point of the book.
It might secretly
be. Google are pricing young people out of the housing market. But look, at Berlin, did you ever read a book called Stasiland by Anna von der Rosen?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so you know that book is all about that. Just your description of people being so conscious of their information and their privacy is intriguing. Very interesting listening to your guest talk about Mark Zuckerberg, says the text. My very true that he is a merchant of blandness. I think young people need a new punk movement to shake things up, just to breathe some life into the mundane. I love that, because it's something that's in the last 5 years or so I've been trying to perpetrate on the toy show, of all things, Roisin. I know we're going all over the shop here.
This is your agenda.
This is my agenda, is to try and embrace those kids who are a bit more punk, a bit more, just a little less Zuckerberg and a little more punk, because they're not conforming, and they're not trying too hard. They're just those kids and those cats and those people that you meet in real life who are just a bit off the beaten track. We need more of them.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is a real, like, flourishing of creativity, and it's so splintered around the world that, I mean, it's a kind of cliche to say it, but you could just be a kid living in the middle of nowhere in your bedroom, like, practicing some creative art. Like, I've basically rigged my entire social media accounts now that all I see when I log in is stuff that makes me happy, which is, you know, creative.
A utopian
stuff.
Echo chamber, yes.
That's it. I have built my own echo chamber, and I really would advise people to do this. It's something, like, it can be your friend, like, you know, your extremely vocal political friend who you agree with in real life. But on the internet, you're seeing this magnified persona, this personal brand version of them, where they may not even believe what they're saying. And I don't think it's a crime to mute them. You know?
Yes. No, I couldn't agree with you more. It's just that when you see ordinarily right-thinking people head down the other echo chamber, which is suited to their needs, and that becomes the QAnon crazy horse stables. But anyway, that's for another day. Roisin, I have to go. Congratulations on The Disconnect. It's going to be finding a home on the shelf in my house, because I now have a very interested party in what you have to say at home. So that's great. And we were all saying that upstairs. Everyone was saying, oh, I want to give that to my son, nephew, niece. And in other words, the people closer to your age than mine. But
the people you're worried about.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it's an important book for the people like me who want to know what people like them are thinking. So everyone's winning.
Yeah.
You know? Good luck in Berlin.
Thank you so much.
When you get there, I should say. Not at all. Congratulations.
Well, when they allow Irish people back.
Exactly. Get on the first plane out of Dodge for sure. Roisin Kiber, thank you for your time this morning. Congratulations on your book, The Disconnect. It's published by Serpent's Tale. It's available now. And like I say, an intriguing insight into the digital natives' trip through that whole murky morass. And beautifully put together, I must say. 12 minutes to 10. Little after 9:30, let us talk to Stacey Solomon, presenter, singer, mother, tidying fanatic, whose career has spanned everything from X Factor to Loose Women and everything in between. And she joins us on the phone now. Good morning, Stacey. Lovely to talk to you.
Morning, Ryan. I've been excited to talk to you.
Likewise. I mean, this, you know, a pandemic is just built for tidying and decluttering, and that's why your book is so timely. I mean, did you need a pandemic to tidy up, or are you a neat freak anyway?
Oh, gosh. I think that's probably one of the biggest misconceptions of Tattoo Tidy is that I'm a constant mess. So every day, obviously, like everyone else, you're just constantly tidying up. So I just thought, oh, this makes it more fun if I do a before and an after picture and tap it. I feel like I've actually done something in the day.
You know, it feels like that. How are you getting on, by the way? You've got a busy house. Introduce us to who's in your world.
Yes, so right now I'm sitting with Zach, Layton and Rick, my three children, mm-hmm. and my dog Theo and Peanut, both dogs. Joe is usually here, but he's working today, so he's out of the house. So, yeah, it's just us here at the moment.
Okay, well, that's busy enough to go, and then you've got to talk to people.
Sorry, it's a bit loud. That's because okay. The baby doesn't understand radio.
But that's Stacey. This is the nature of the modern age. So it's absolutely totally fine. You have about, 4 million followers on Instagram?
Oh, yeah. Something like that.
What do they most want from you? What do you do for them, do you think, more than anything else?
Oh, God, I don't think I do anything. I just think they're just a bunch of nice people and everyone's looking for someone to chat to, including myself. Like half the time I just am like, oh, I need a bit of a break from my family. Who else can I talk to? So I go on Instagram and I think, oh, I've got a nice little community of people to have a little chat with, and that is as simple as that. I think, oh God, I'm sorry.
It's all kicking off
taking
now.
Taking a pan away from the baby. I was like, oh no, this is going to turn into a pan.
How old is the baby?
He is going to be 2 in May.
So he's, oh, he's so
1 3/4.
3/4, I was trying to do the sums there.
I've lost track of the months. You know what it's like? The first 6 months, you remember, and then you're like, oh, God, I don't know how many months he is now. He's getting old.
It's so true. So he's that age, there's a lot of curiosity, there's a lot of toddling around, and there's a lot of trouble.
Yeah, exactly. But I wouldn't have it any other way. He's lovely. All the boys are lucky. I've got really amazing children. So, yeah, I'm really proud of them.
I love that.
Noisy, but amazing. Yeah,
of course. I love that in the book you talk about that when you were young and you were a single mom and you had, I think you were 18 when you had Zach, and, you know, you lived with your mom and your sister and your brother working on tax credits and so forth. There was a sense that before all this fame and, I suppose, wealth that goes with it came into your life, you had a real grounding in reality, and that this probably helped inform a little bit of the organising and the lack of waste.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, when I had Zach, it's not that I was tidy in any way, shape or form, but I did have to, like, immediately become organised, because you know what it's like when I was finishing my college A-levels at the time. So he was in the college creche, and then I was working of a night time to pay towards my college stuff. So I would have to arrange childcare. I would get like milk vouchers, which were really, really helpful at the time and really useful because milk was so expensive. And then I would get working tax credits to top up my wages at the fish and chip shop so I could afford like the nappies, everything else. So I just had to make sure and be really vigilant about everything and organise every bit of childcare, every bit of money that was going in and out to make sure I didn't run out by the end of the week. And I think that it just threw me into a reality, because before then I was obviously just a carefree kid who thought I'd never die and I'll never have responsibilities and I'll just live like, you know, a superhero forever.
Yeah.
And then you give birth and then there's somebody relying on you and you just have to, I just really have to like kick myself up the bum basically and get myself in gear. I couldn't be scatty. I couldn't leave Zach on the bus on the way to school. Do you know what I mean? I have to just make sure I'm remembered everything.
Yeah. And it, that would have helped, I suspect, like inform who you are now. I mean, you're probably, you know, careful, or you're also mindful of other people who don't have the good things that you do have now.
Yeah, I think there's always, even when I was in that position, there was always people out there struggling even more, in worse off positions, without any family. My biggest privilege is my family. I genuinely feel that without them, I wouldn't have been able to do anything that I've been able to do. They're just the most incredible support network I could ever wish for.
Yes.
And I do appreciate that so many people just don't have that.
So
I do feel really extremely lucky and privileged all of the time.
I remember watching you on X Factor, and you just felt, it felt watching you that you were like somebody who didn't really, you just kind of came out of the blue. You didn't feel to me polished, and I felt that was very refreshing. You didn't come fully formed. Is there's a compliment in there somewhere, Stacey?
Oh no, don't worry. It's true, 100% true. When I look back at my first audition, there's like stains on my shirt and on my shoes. I had like baby sick on my shoes. I was just really like scruffy and. Yeah. You know what it's like. You just think to yourself, I'll just go for it. You know, what's the worst that can happen? And I remember saying to my mum when I was doing it, oh, mum, if this is it, that'll be fine. Like, this is the most incredible experience on its own. And it really was an incredible experience. And I'm so proud of the X Factor and where I came from. Like, I have the fondest memories. And that would absolutely have been enough for me, like, forever, because I just loved it. The fact that I've been lucky enough to be given other opportunities and do other bits and pieces is just a real, like, gift, like a real bonus. I'm just, I do feel really lucky, because there's so many talented people out there, much more talented than me, that deserve the opportunities I've been given. They might not necessarily get them. So.
Of course. And in fact, Maria was saying, would you ask Stacey Solomon, why doesn't she sing as much anymore? I remember hearing her sing. She had a fabulous voice. We don't hear her as much. Are you still singing, or what's happening there?
I love singing, and I do sing like for my own pleasure.
Oh, okay.
As a kid, and I didn't enjoy the pressure of singing, like bringing out an album and being on a record label and having it's a really scary industry and a massive pressure, and I didn't enjoy that commercial side of it. But I love it. I'll still get on the karaoke. I'll still sing and sit with the kids. Sitting big with the kids.
What's your go-to karaoke sort of number?
What's up?
Oh, right, okay.
I absolutely love that song. Now, you know the one that's like, and I said, hey!
I think to myself, what's going on? That one.
Exactly.
I know that song.
Best
I know.
Song ever.
Four Non-Blondes, I think yes.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. That's a good song, because actually you could probably get a lot of pent-up whatever out singing that.
It is literally like therapy singing that song.
It.
You can just scream it and shout it.
you also won I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here in 2010. And you know, you joined Loose Women. So all of these things lead to, you know, great success and career contentment. You strike me as being somebody who's comfortable in her skin. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, definitely I have moments where I question myself or doubt myself like most people, but I mean, it doesn't get me anywhere. There's one thing I've learned about my negative thoughts or, you know, my doubts. Yeah. They literally serve me no purpose whatsoever.
Well, that's
so
true.
The best thing I can do is just go, okay, I acknowledge that I feel like that sometimes, but I might as well just go around life being like a shallow how and imagining that everything's lovely.
You know, you like to quote Eleanor Roosevelt saying, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. It's a great quote.
It's one of my favourite quotes ever, because it's so true. There's so many people out there that might say certain things to you, about you, try and make you feel like you're a failure or you're not good enough. And actually, the only person who can make you feel like that is you, by accepting those words and letting those words in. And we have full control most of the time on whether we decide to allow those people to have that kind of power over us.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah, you'd be glad to know that they've announced that they're doing a collectible Barbie modelled after Eleanor Roosevelt. So you must get your hands on one of those.
I am glad to know that. I will be getting my hands on one of those.
Let me ask you about in Tap 2 Tidy, your book. The one of the things that got a lot of conversation going in our office when it came out, pictures came out, where you hang the crisps on hooks, bags of crisps on hooks. Not hooks, they're little clips.
Yeah, they're little curtain clips on a mini curtain rod.
Yeah.
Do you know what? It's just a bit of fun for me. I think when you do something that just makes you smile or laugh, and even if it's silly and ridiculous, I just think, go for it. Why the hell not? And when I hang my crisps up, I genuinely, every time I do it after the food shop, I look at it and think, oh, it's like a little cupboard of crisps, like a clothes aisle of crisps, but I can actually eat them.
It's like
edible clothes.
A walk-in crisp robe. Yeah. And you do the same with the shoes, but that's all part of it. Tex wants to know, can you, is your book okay for 12-year-olds?
I don't think it really has an age on it. It's just, basically, it's a, sorry, I have a very moody baby.
I have to laugh. Those screams are going through my head. I don't know how you're doing it, sitting there talking.
It's like white noise, isn't it?
It is a bit. You're probably like, so used to it. But it's very human, so keep going. You're doing great. Keep going. Go on.
I think the book's suitable for anyone, if I'm completely honest. It's just a fun sort of book that hopefully people can lose themselves in for a little bit and distract them from the things that might be going on in the world. And yeah, it's like a book of hobbies, a book of crafts and organising and snacks and just fun, silly little things that make me smile, bring me joy. So hopefully they can do the same to somebody else.
Exactly, like hand a frying pan to your child and hope they run out of the kitchen. And
literally.
I like your idea to limit screen time by having Saturday crafternoons. Good word.
Oh, do you know what? Anything to limit screen time. Ryan, all they want to do is be on their PlayStations, especially with the pandemic and then being at home. And you would have thought, having to homeschool on a laptop all day, they would just be sick of the screen, but they're not. God, they can't get enough of it. Mm. And sometimes, do you know what? It's all well and good saying let's limit screen time and blah, blah, blah. Yes, we must get and doing other things. Yes. Important, but also I tell you what else is important, giving them the screen sometimes and saying, go for your life, have the screen for as long as you want just so I can have 5 minutes.
I'd say your interpretation of what people recommend and what people actually do is probably more real than anything I've heard.
I think it's a balance. It's all right to go, oh, let's go for a walk, get them off those tellies. But then when you get home, it's all right to go, do you know what? Go for it, because I also need time without you. You're always here.
I need some me time. Now, beat it, kid. Let's go. So a tweet from Brona says, I'm dying laughing here at Stacey's kids running mad in the background around her.
Literally running mad.
Yeah, could not be more on brand, says the text. Another from Marietta says, I had the pleasure of meeting Stacey a couple of years ago. She's even lovelier in real life. A nice, genuine person. Thank you, Marietta Doran, for that. Stacey, Orla in Cork says, Stacey Solomon is just a breath of fresh air, a kind, lovely soul and so grounded. She doesn't take things for granted. Like when she talked about getting milk vouchers for her baby when she was a teenage mum, lots of teenagers could take a leaf out of her book. So a lot of love for you in Ireland, Stacey.
Oh, do you know what? I love coming to Ireland so much. I was so excited to come on your show, and I'm just gutted I don't get to actually come, because I'd love to do like book signings and meet people. And yeah, obviously with
you
the situation, we can't do any of that.
You do it in good
Please
time.
God, hopefully in time, we'll get that chance. But I do love coming to Ireland. It's one of my favourite places ever.
Well, you're always welcome here. You know that. I enjoy watching you also with Joe on Celebrity Gogglebox, one of my favourite programmes. Is that fun to do, or do you hate that bit? Or
it is really fun, but it's a long old record, because you've got to sit there and watch all them shows.
Yeah.
So like, you're sort of sitting there, and then you forget the cameras are there. So then you just have your normal conversations and think, oh God, I hope they don't put that in. And they obviously do.
They do.
So you watch it back and you think, oh my God, that is terrible. But no, anything I get to do with Joe is such a, like, I genuinely just love it because I feel a bit more relaxed when I'm working with him. I feel like he's got my back. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Like,
nothing can go wrong because Joe's there. That makes sense.
How did you meet Joe?
We met on a. We first met in the jungle when I came when I did the show and I came out, but I don't remember that very much at all. Mm. And then we met again on a show called Virtually Famous, which was just a panel show that we both happened to be on. And he said, "Oh, you should come out to the jungle and do the after show." And then lo and behold, they asked me to come out that year, so I did. And yeah, we acted, I don't know, we just. I think we just fell in love with each other, to be honest. He's so funny and silly and kind, and he's such a good dad. And I remember just thinking, while I was spending time with him, like, he's my person. That's my kind of person. Mm. He doesn't take himself too seriously, and he really cares about people. He's got, like, the biggest heart, which I just love.
And you got engaged. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Not we did get engaged. I keep forgetting.
A text says, "I always remember Stacey having to walk across a line of chairs in very high heels and singing to the audience in X Factor." That must have been so difficult.
That was my jeopardy in the X Factor. That was. Here you go, darling.
Who is this?
This is Rick. And he wants his bottle.
And is that what you just handed him, the bottle?
Yeah, I just gave him the bottle. Now he's resting on my hip as I walk around. And try and keep him quiet while I'm on the phone.
You are a very hardworking woman. That's the truth.
Oh no, honestly. Every woman's a hardworking woman.
That's true.
So have I actually.
So let's keep going. Ask Stacey, please. Any more clotheslines coming out from lockdown? If lockdown ever ends, Inga wants to know.
Oh my goodness, yes. So I'm working on Primark Kids again, which I did last year, which I absolutely loved. I got to come to Ireland for that as well, because you've got it's Pennies in Ireland.
Yes, well spotted. €5 Pennies, yeah.
Yeah. So I got to do the Pennies launch in Ireland, which was brilliant. So hopefully, please God, it comes out at the end of this year. So hopefully I'll get to do that again. And then I am working on a womenswear collection for somebody who I'm really excited about, but I can't say much yet.
That's okay. Elizabeth was on to say, "That noise of children in the background is the first interview I've heard of a mum really having children. They shout and scream and Stacey keeps talking." I think you've brought a shot of reality into the arm of people listening this morning.
I bet their poor ears.
Very complimentary. Pamela and Sword says, "Stacey's like a breath of fresh air. She's real, she's natural, she's in touch with real people. She's a joy. Saw her on The Chase, Loose Women and The X Factor. She's honest and genuine. I love her. She deserves all the good that comes her way." I mean, there's... And on it goes. Listen, I'm going to let you go with the babies and the bottles and the chats, but fair play to you for motoring on through. You're quite the pro, and I'll see you in real life soon, Stacey.
I'm so grateful you have me on. Thank you. Lots of love to you and everyone.
And to you and yours. Okay, see you soon.
Bye,
mind
darling.
Yourself. See you soon.
God bless. Bye.
Bye, Rex. Bye, Stacey. There they go in the kitchen of chaos. I love that because that's as real as it ever going to get, you know, in a busy house. That's what it works. I think a lot of people listening in this morning going, yeah, I just heard My World on the radio. Stacey Solomon joining us live this morning. Tap to Tidy is her book. It's online, available from all good bookshops and so on. And fair play to her for keeping it going. Good on her.